with fossil man. It's one of those things that bothers so many students when they get in class, because this becomes pretty dogmatic on the part of general evolutionists. If you look at the actual evidence, you'll see in a minute a great similarity with one of the other ones that we put up, and maybe someone will notice it and they will be able to answer that question, which I may direct this direction. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, you have the slide. You can start that right now. Do I have it? Oh, sorry. What you're going to see here is a series of magazine covers, the kind of thing that you would find on the newsstand at different times. I bought them all that way. Some will be illustrations that have come in as something that was sent to me by the publisher when we started a new book, or perhaps some book that I bought and I took it out. This is all general reading. This is not generally, most of this is not textbook stuff. It's just stuff that you see on the front cover of a magazine like National Geographic. That is the first magazine that was ever published with a hologram. And I don't think you can do it the way you see it there, but if you have the magazine in your hand, you can turn it and go from a skull to a face. And it basically has to do with the whole search that people are making for early man. The technical way of looking at that, though, is not just early man, but the transition of man from some kind of primitive ancestor that led to apes and orangutans and man. And so that kind of thing costs a lot of money. And I'm going to show you one that I had sent to me, or at least to our house in 1970, which was a 16-page full-color fold-out on man's evolution. And that, again, was sent. That one was sent out by the Lifetime series. I mean, that is a lot of money. I don't know, just to make a 16, 8.5 by 11, 16 panels in full color and send it out to people in the United States. And I found out later that they basically sent it to people who were already professed committed to being a biologist and teachers and so on. I'm not exactly sure why it came to our house, maybe just because we were taking that series in as a family. So this is just the kind of thing that you see in nature. You have the African origins. This is one about the plot to kill evolution. If you want a conspiracy theory for everything, this would be the one you'd want to read, because it's a big conspiracy theory. It's like this is all being planned out in the background to try to destroy this in the schools. There's a Scientific American. This is an interesting one because this little fossil is so small, and it's not a child. They can tell that from the fossilized bones. But it's so small, it's smaller than any of the other little people that we have in the fossil record. And so they're not quite sure what to do with this one at the moment. So when I got my book, I had this as a transparency to show my students. I had this as a transparency to show my students. I had this as a transparency to show my students. I had this as a transparency. There were a lot of things. I want you to notice that in this one, not only do they have the Siamang gibbon, and they have the common gibbon, and they have the gorilla, the common chimpanzee, but they have the orangutan, where it would be the human, and they have a picture of the author of the book, you know. So we're just going to put the humans right in with all of these other things. Now, it has a message, obviously, right? It has a message to students that we are really no different from the rest of these, even if you think that you're a little bit more advanced. And so I thought that was the kind of interesting thing that would come in. And I don't usually use in my presentations, but you can just find some magazine that's dealing with some concept of evolution at almost any time on the newsstand someplace. So I want you to remember what I've said. I do not have chemical evolution up here on this particular one, but I've never been able to find a way to duplicate that background that looks like a notepad. If any of you can figure that out, I'll add the chemical evolution in. Sorry. I'm practical. I like the pad. So anyway, the idea that students are going to have to learn to be consistent in making this distinction between chemical, special, and general. And when I come up here, you know, we've basically talked about me coming up to talk about evolution, but we never actually defined it, did we? We never actually said, you know, David's going to come up here and talk to us about general evolution and special evolution and chemical evolution and this whole controversy. That might be the best way to introduce it, right? And when you use the word evolution, you should always put chemical, special, or general in front of it, and that will be the very first step in trying to change the way people look at this. Because a general evolutionist will never make that distinction. And yet you've already realized from that last lesson that you do believe in natural selection, which was the beginning of evolutionary arguments. And it is still the core of all evolutionary arguments. It's what we can see in natural selection, things that we can do and observe and do in the lab and see in the field. We get that. And once you just lump that in with all the rest, you lose the distinction. We need to make the distinction. And it's hard to do that because myself, a lot of times I'll talk about evolution and I'm talking about the general theory. And I just use the word evolution instead of saying general evolution. So that's one thing that all of you can do, no matter what your age is, your background. If you use that before it, it will make a great difference. And I would urge you students particularly, look at those books, and as you're reading in those chapters, see if you can see where the evidence stops and the interpretation begins, because it'll all be wrapped around it. You'll have evidence with all this interpretation wrapped around it, and sometimes it's really hard to peel that off. But the better you get at that, the more clearly you will see this whole issue. So the second thing is that you have to learn to see and understand where that evidence stops and the interpretation begins, what I was just saying. And this is very important. Ultimately, after we've studied everything that we can possibly do with our human mind, whatever position we take is going to be a faith position. If you're a general evolutionist, you are going to have to accept certain things on faith, whether you want to admit it or not. You want to say, oh no, this is a scientific concept. Well, there's certain things to support a natural selection, but there's nothing to support that inanimate dead matter can become a living cell. We've never seen it happen. The one experiment that was offered to try to show that from those early gases, which we actually do not know what the early gases were in the on the Earth, that's a faith statement that somehow you can get from atoms of various things and move them to make a cell that has a living membrane that has the ability to self-replicate based on chemical things like chemical molecules like DNA and RNA, and it has the ability to synthesize its own food if it's a green plant, and then eat that food that it's produced to put oxygen in the atmosphere. Those are the kinds of things that have to be answered. So don't think that this is a faith issue just on our part. I'm not embarrassed about the fact that I believe on faith. I said it the other night, maybe it was last night, but if God came down in 60,000 years to the scientists of that day and explained to them how he created, they would still not understand him if he talked to them directly. And the reason that I know that is because God talks to us directly about his truths, and we don't seem to understand it. He talks to us about he made our bodies to do this, and to be a glory to his name, and yet we still don't quite understand that we're supposed to take our bodies and bring glory to his name. We allow them to suit our own purposes and to fulfill our own desires. So, you know, we are certainly guilty of that, and science is not going to answer this, and our faith will never be positive, or you would not have faith. And I just can't emphasize that enough. You have to, I don't know, I had a friend who once said, a mature person is a person who can live with some unanswered questions. You know, our faith will take care of the unanswered questions. I'm not about to give up what I have seen happen in my life as I have tried to serve Christ, and what I know God has done to help me. And the more I trust in him, the more I see God helping me. I'm not going to give that up for a theory that's just has nothing to do with the power of God. I'm not saying that I haven't studied it. I've studied it. It's just, it doesn't answer enough questions in my life. You know, if you get life from non-life, how does that answer the question of how I'm supposed to treat my neighbor? How does that answer the question of whether I should seduce that young girl or I should allow my daughter to be seduced by somebody? How do I answer those questions? You can't answer those questions on the basis of just these concepts that do not contain anything about authority. They don't contain anything about where the idea and the essence of evil came from, how it is in this world today, what is the essence of good, the battle that's going on with principalities and powers. I don't see where any of that stuff has ever been in one of my textbooks. But people will take it and say, oh, well, there just isn't any purpose to this life. Do you not have friends that say, there's no purpose to this life? I have somebody in my own family, not my immediate family of Darlene and I and the kids, but who does not believe that God exists and does not believe that there's a heaven or a hell, and so has chosen to live their life for the most part, for at least 25 years, doing things that God despises with no guilt. Because the concept in his mind that he's been taught is that God is something that we create, not something that created us. And since we create him, we can decreate him. We can take him out of our minds, and we can just live based on the feelings and the desires that we have. And I just think that is the saddest thing. You know, why would you ever do any good at all? Why would you do any good at all in this life if you believe that? Why wouldn't you just saturate your life with the things you want and the desires you want to fulfill? It makes no sense to me. But people can choose what they want, can't they? God gave us a choice. So we're going to have to decide, and we will not have all the answers. So it is a matter of faith. We'll accept or reject whatever interpretation we look at, ultimately as a faith thing. So look at this, if you can read it. I tried to make it a little larger. And tell me what you recognize about this. We find that the larger groups of animals, although variously unlike in appearance, have similar organ systems for digestion, excretion, and other necessary functions. All animals in some phyla and some in most of the others have a firm framework or skeleton which gives physical support and protection for the body. Do you recognize any of these? It's what I put up basically for comparative anatomy. What you're going to see tonight is a lot of comparative anatomy going to see a lot of comparative anatomy, particularly of ape-like skeletons and human skeletons. That's what makes it into the magazines. So let's look at that for a minute. And excuse me. Oops, I'm going backwards. Excuse me. Okay, we showed this once before. Well, if you go back, never mind. I showed this once before, and that was in comparative anatomy. Are they alike? Yes, they are. And what did we decide about similarity? What was the conclusion of how we could look at the similarity in reference to this world and how it's been created that would make us believe that it's exactly what you would expect if God did it? I can't hear you.
The same designer.
And I don't remember whether I said this, but there are two chemical processes that must go on at the same time, and that's respiration and photosynthesis. Plants photosynthesize. They make their own food and they give off oxygen. 50% of the oxygen that's in the atmosphere comes from the Brazilian rainforests. 50%. When we cut down trees, we cut down things that create oxygen for us and take away our the CO2 that we give out. Animals. Can you make your own food? You cannot make your own food, right? You have to take vegetables at the bottom. All of us are vegetarians. Some of us are just once or twice removed, but everybody has to eat things that have been that go back to the level of organisms that make their own food, and that's photosynthetic organisms. So what do we think of in our own bodies? Well, we get food in, and we have to burn it. We burn it in respiration. When we burn it in respiration, we give off CO2, and we gain energy from it. But I can't make my own food to burn, but plants can. Those two things have to go on the face of the earth and be balanced in the atmosphere. Now, basically, we can change that. People don't recognize that we can change it by putting excess CO2 into the air, various things like that, and change the balance. And we don't know all of the things that could happen when we do that. So you have these things that look alike, and they look alike as far as I'm concerned, because there is a great designer. He used a common plan. He used common molecules, four different groups, because that thing that lives on the rock is something that makes something that I need in my body. And the whole concept of a food web is based on that. It's a common design. It shows a designer. And it shows why every organism has to be in a food chain and a food web. And that takes care of the similarity. So what do we do when we start seeing that similarity with reference to man and ape? Now, I have to apologize because this was on a transparency. Do any of the millennials know what a transparency? Never mind. No, that's a joke. Anyway, when I put that Darlene and I were having our golden anniversary, I facetiously wrote in the Facebook post, "Now, for you if you millennials don't know what a golden anniversary is, go ask your parents. And if they don't know, go ask your grandparents." And I put a lot of periods after it, because we lose these things. You know, I don't know. When did you learn there was such a thing as a telephone booth? You know what a telephone booth is? Okay, never mind. Like I said, poor Superman. So in this, you have a full-grown ape skeleton, not the way it would stand. They can stand like that almost, but it is not very easy for them, all right? They do not have an S-shaped curve to their spine. They just have this. So they're designed to be humped over and basically walk on all fours most of the time. So you look at the man's skeleton, you look at the ape skeleton, it's just like looking at the man's skeleton and the horse skeleton. They're very, very similar. So some of the things that we could say about this would be exactly like you said. I could make the argument from the standpoint of this similarity is there because God used a common design, because he was the thought process and the creator of everything that we have. Now, this is the This is a chart that came into my advanced evolutionary theory class, and it was my same professor, who I dearly love and who I think likes me but thinks I'm insane, but then a lot of you are acting on that same basis. Anyway, and what he wrote up there were a bunch of different places where you would compare skeletons. And what they look for, whenever they're looking for a common ancestor to things, they take some kind of fossil characteristic, like the size of the skull, the actual cc's, the cubic centimeters of the skull. And what you find is that there is a gap between the largest ape skull and the smallest human skull. Now, he said that. We know that's actually not true now, but that was what he said. And he talked about all sorts of characteristics within the skeletal thing. But he didn't talk about hearts. Why didn't he talk about hearts? How do you compare hearts of great ape skeletons in the fossil record and human skeletons in the fossil record?
It's not there anymore.
It's not there. No soft tissues. You don't know about hair. You don't know about skin. You don't know about muscle. You don't know about any of the internal organs within those creatures. So basically, all of this comparative stuff that's been done with fossils like this has been done on the bones, which are most likely to actually fossilize. So you're leaving a lot of that organism, and quite frankly, you can't tell anything about the intelligence of an organism just by the number of cc's in the skull. You can't just look at the volume of the skull and assume that the brain was that big. It's a good assumption, but because we've never found one that wasn't like that unless it was diseased. But look what you're leaving out. You don't know whether a brain small like that could actually function like a human brain. Because at some point, any of these fossils that come out that they say were ape-like or what have you, there has to be some that start thinking like humans do. And so we've had some discussions while I've been there, just between people that we've been with, about this whole concept of how do you know that something's human? What is it that makes us different from the rest of the animal kingdom? So if somebody asked you that question, what would you actually say? What is it that's different about humans from the rest of the animals? Because we certainly are made like them, right? Similar organs for digestion, excretion, respiratory functions, the heart. Let's put it down another level. You have a yappy old chihuahua. What makes you different from the chihuahua? Not when you're angry, because then you're yapping too, but what would make us different from our pets? We have a conscience. Of course, the snippy little answer to that would be, how do you know they don't have a conscience? Maybe they just don't want to hurt your feelings. But we don't think they have a conscience, do we? Do you think that they get up in the morning and say, oh, I got to go eat? Or do you think they just feel hunger and they go eat? Do they think about whether to run through Wendy's drive-thru or McDonald's drive-thru? I'm talking about restaurants I know. I take Darlene out a lot and I try to take her to the best. So if you look at it that way, they don't seem to look at life like I do. I mean, I can worry over anything, and I don't think they worry at all. And I can reflect on what I worry about. And what I worried about last week, people say that I worry too much. I'm just going to tell you that. It's a part of my reputation. In fact, one person said one day, if David doesn't have anything to worry about, he worries. Okay. We'll mark that out, and we won't use that one again. So that's the whole concept. So with me, it's the idea of reflective thinking. I don't know of an animal that I believe has the capability to reflect on its own death, its own impending death. I don't think they think about it, and I don't think they reflect on it. They don't reflect on the dying process. They just live their lives. They basically get up in the morning and they go find food, and they become sexual, they have babies, and then they die. And their genes are passed on. They just don't reflect about it. And we probably are the only organisms on the face of the earth where the females worry about what they're going to wear on their wedding day. Big time worry, right? Big time worry. So I'm just saying, you think in your mind for a while tonight about what is it that makes us different from animals. There is not one cat or dog or deer or bear or possum or skunk that came to my lectures. There's not a one in here, is there? I know there's no skunk. Don't you? Okay, we'll just cross that off. There's two. So the whole thing here is to just go home tonight and think about what actually makes us different from other organisms. And none of that fossilizes. Sometimes they can find tools with some of these fossils that are very human-like. And if they find tools, then they say it's human, because it's a tool maker, and it can make plans, and it can go out and do stone hatchet experiments on things, you know. So you think about that tonight. Now, what I want to do is get around to a little bit different approach than just the comparative anatomy stuff that we talked about before. But you see it all the time. This is out of that new Scientific American I showed you a while ago. There are lots of similarities between humans and chimps. Actually, that was not supposed to be the first one. It was supposed to be that one. Now, I'm not perfectly clear on who has the time to do this kind of stuff. Computer people are weird. Unfortunately, we need them, and we keep them around for that reason alone. And then we have to suffer through stuff like this. So this is not my modified one, darling. This is that other one again. Anyway, I had to laugh at that, because it is true that expressions in some of these animals are very much like the expressions that we have. Anyway, I thought it was funny. So what was it I didn't like about this? Well, my friend John Clark was showing this transparency, and he decided it ought to have blue letters, and he took a magic marker and he put blue, and then nobody can read them at all. In fact, I can hardly read them, and I know what's supposed to be there. So that was a frustration. But what I can tell you is there is nothing on there except that last line, the three on the last line, that has anything to do with any other concept in the body other than bones, because bones fossilize. And at the bottom, my professor put less body hair and more body hair. And I asked him, I said, how do you know that? And then eventually he said, well, you can't know. So he took it off. You have no skin, and you say you don't know whether it was bald or not. I mean, really, I think Ramapithecus and the Australopithecines were all bald. I do not think they had all that hair on their head, but I can't prove that. So this is what we've had. I want you to understand that there is a book you can get from the National Academy of Science that is called Science and Creationism. And I found this a long time ago, and it's still around with a few additions to what was there in my original copy. But this is what that book says about human evolution. It says, studies in evolutionary biology have led to the conclusion that mankind, interesting choice of words, right, that mankind arose from ancestral primates. This association was hotly debated among scientists in Darwin's day. before molecular biology and the discovery of the now abundant connecting links. Today, however, there is no significant scientific doubt about the close evolutionary relationships among all primates or between apes and humans. The missing links that troubled Darwin and his followers are no longer missing. Today, not one, but many such connecting links, intermediate between various branches of the primate family tree, have been found as fossils. And these linking fossils are intermediate in form and occur in geologic deposits of intermediate age. They thus document both the time and the rate at which primate and human evolution occurred. Period, right? You put a dot on it and that's it. You never have to think about it again. That's what we know. Unfortunately, it just isn't true. That statement is still in the new one. If you get it today in 2016, that section will say exactly the same thing. And they know it's not true. And I know it's not true. Now, one of the things that you may have noticed about me is that I don't call anybody a liar. I mean, what good is it to call somebody a liar? I said it before. If you think somebody's lying, bring the discussion back around to how can you prove to me you're not lying? Because everything else is irrelevant. If they lie, any other discussion is irrelevant to you. And I don't do that. I have lots of friends who are biologists who struggle with this. They really do struggle with this. They say they believe this, but if you ask them questions, you know, they believe in love of their family. I don't know why. There's nothing in evolutionary theory that would say that you would have love, much less a selfless, self-sacrificing kind of love like Jesus had. There's no particular reason for love to even be in our bodies, all right? And none of the other animals have love. Do they have sexual attraction? Yes, they do. But they don't have love any more than they have a language like ours with the complexity of ours or reflective thinking. So I'm not upset with these people, and if you can get to the point where you're not upset with them, but you think that they are going down the wrong path, you ought to have some concern for them. And while you may not want to study it, like some of us have, like myself and others have tried to go really deep into this, and we've stayed down longer in the deep than you all ever have, and the question about whether we're going to come up is always there, and we're not sure yet, but we've gone down deeper than anybody else. You're going to find that there are just questions like that that come across your mind. But most of the biologists that I know, they're not all dogmatic. Some are, but not all of them. And so you don't want to just classify people and say, this is what an evolutionist is like. This is their personality. This is how they beat up on kids. You don't want to take a view like that. You just want to listen to what they say. And by them saying it, they show one of the greatest differences between us and any other animal on the face of the earth. They don't debate. You will never have to worry about some disgusting debate where people are yelling at one another ever again in the animal kingdom. You know? King of the jungle. Not really. The lion never went through a political process like we're going through. King of the jungle? No. He just thinks he is. But the point on the whole thing is, if we are debating this, we are different. If we have strong feelings about this, we are different than any other organism. And you cannot just dismiss them. Now, I have a professor who's a very dear person to me. He's young. He has children. I love his wife. I love his kids. I love him. He's very good at the work that he does. He's not an evolutionary biologist per se, but I love that the work that he does on wetlands and what's happening with wetlands. And he has on his door, DNA is life, the rest is translation. In other words, life really is just your DNA, and that's all it is. He does not believe that, though. And I know he doesn't believe it, because I know he loves his wife and he loves his children. So I was sitting in there talking with him one day, and he had this really neat antique map up framed on the wall. And I said, well, Stephen, that is really neat. Where'd you get that? He says, well, my wife gave it to me as an anniversary present. You know, he says, I know that's a little bit geeky, but I like it. You know, I kind of love that particular map. And I didn't say anything about it then because I love the map too. And I was kind of trying to figure out how I could steal it. But we won't go into that, okay? The bottom line on this whole thing is that later on, I went back into his office and I sat down and I said, Stephen, I just want to ask you a question. You know, I know what bumper sticker you have stuck to your door. I said, the love you have for your wife, the love you have for your children, and the love that you have for that map, is that DNA or is that translation? I mean, is it ingrained in his DNA to do that? I don't know of any other organism who can sit and talk about it, who can have philosophical discussions. You know, like, will Alabama win? Will Georgia win? Those are philosophical discussions, of course. So we are really different. So I want you to look at what happened in my life. I read this to you, and I blew it up so you could see it, and you can't see it. I'll get off of that. So we're back to the place where I really started, and that was that 16 page, 11 and a half by 8 and a half by 11 pages, 16 of them all folded up inside this nature library. If you find that in a used bookstore, open it up and you see if it has that fold out and pay the $2 to get that book, because you'll see the same chart that I had. And it really is an interesting chart. Whoa, punched the wrong thing. This is it. Isn't that exciting? I had to kind of cut and paste pictures to get that up there, but that's pretty much what it looked like. And I know that when my professor brought it in, he just wanted me to do one thing. He held it up like this to show that in one line, and he said, David, here's the evidence. Draw a line between ape and man. That was the second time in the class that I went, well, and I said, will you give me some time on that one? I don't have an answer for you today. That took the pressure off. I didn't have to get red in the face or angry or anything. So he gave me the time. I had to think about it for a while. But what is wrong with the question he asked me? Can you tell by looking at that? I usually bring it so that you can really see it a little bit better, but I don't know where it's gone to. Do you have a place where lost things are in your house? Safe places? Yeah, I thought so. So what is the problem with what he asked me? What was he asking me? Draw the line. This is the evidence. Think on it a minute.
That's not evidence.
Right. That's not evidence. So what is it?
It's an interpretation.
It's an interpretation of the evidence. That it's pasted all over the evidence, but it is an interpretation, correct? All of the stuff that's been put on the outside of the skeletons is interpretation. And so it struck me as unusual because I'd been told by somebody that all of the bones for these intermediate common ancestors that have been proposed would fit inside a peach basket. So I went to the head of the anthropology department. Physical anthropology. And I was talking to him about it. I told him I was a graduate student in biology. And I said, you know, what about that bone thing? He says, oh, yeah. He says, it's just like this chart. And he pulled out that chart. He says, it's just like Ramapithecus and some of the others in there. You know, we only have a very few bones for that particular one in the list. And I said, well, you know, doesn't that kind of mislead students? How do you draw something like that if you don't have all of the skeleton? And he said, well, it's easy. You just look what came after it and what came before it, and you fill it in. And That was such an amazing admission, and he was serious. It never crossed his mind what he was actually saying. I caught it because I understand the implications of that. What he was saying was, no, we don't actually have that much evidence. We just have a little, but this is what we think happened, and so we just drew it the way we thought it ought to be. Now, you can get all locked up on what you see as the dishonesty in that, but that doesn't get you anywhere. So I just said, well, if you do that, don't you sort of beg the question about this coming from that when you don't have the small stuff? And then he sort of caught on that maybe he was talking to somebody who was not normal. I'm not taking that off the list. That actually will deserve a laugh, and I'm going to make you do that later. But anyway, so the idea is he kind of caught on that I was, he says, where did you say you were a graduate student? You know, and he began to get kind of red in the face, you know. And that pretty much ended that discussion. I don't know how to say it any simpler. You know, he just wasn't going to talk to me anymore. So I kind of pursued that on my own. Now, this is the newest one. And I will say this, that this particular new one, I have more respect for them for laying it out that way. Laying it out that way. I'm sorry. I was looking at the track star on the right. I'd actually not noticed that. It was an Olympic year. And it's become so much a part of our lives that we have jokes like that. I don't know whether you can see that. I'm not going to tell you what college that is that he has on his helmet. But that idea that the football player is the beginning of this just cracked me up, okay? We have, you know, I can't read it. We have Java Man, we have Peking Man, we have Cro-Magnon, and we have Jazz Man. Hard audience tonight, Darlene. They must have just eaten or something. Anyway, this is kind of the jokes that are built around it. And the one that I thought was really great, forget that one. This is the one. Now, I'm not going to go back. Sorry. You've been bad boys and girls. This one is the best, the evolution of the stick man. And every time I look at it and I think about it, I just laugh a little bit harder. It's just too cute. So people have a real sense of humor about this, and I appreciate that, but it rests on something that's a little bit more serious to me, and that is that people have talked about this kind of flow of evolution in humans so much that everybody knows what that's talking about. It's that ingrained in our society that they know exactly what that's talking about. And if you ask them, well, what's that based on? They'd say, well, that ape to man thing that we know that happened. And that's my concern. Don't mind if somebody presents their view as long as they show the evidence. So I want to show you something about the evidence. Now, Ramapithecus is up there. I think he's the last one across the top. I can't read it, but I think that's Ramapithecus. Yep. Last one over here. Whoa, what happened to this head? What happened here? You don't know? What's the matter, geek? You can't figure that out. I'm sorry, Perry. That was really mean. Anyway, I didn't know that the heads were cut off on this. This is the actual picture of that particular sequence in the chart that I got in the mail. All right, so Ramapithecus, I can't really point, okay? Ramapithecus is over here. Is his head on there on this one? Sure it is. Ramapithecus, the earliest man-like primate found so far. Ramapithecus is now thought to be the oldest of man's ancestors in a direct line. And this human status is based upon a few teeth, some fragments of a skull, and a palate that is human in shape. All right, so let's get down to our anatomy stuff. So we understand the idea of a few teeth. All right. You can come to Kentucky to some kind of meeting and some fragments of a jaw, All right. Where Darlene is probably going to plant her fist tonight. And a palate unmistakably human in shape. So where's your palate? It's where that peanut butter gets stuck when you're eating a peanut butter sandwich. You have a hard palate and a soft palate. And that hard palate just sticks that stuff up there and you can't get it off. And some of that Halloween candy. Kids, be careful. Some of that Halloween candy gets stuck up there and you may suck it down into your lungs. So there's Ramapithecus. That's what it was based on. That whole organism that you see drawn up there was based on a few fragments and of a few teeth, part of a jaw, and a palate. So it turns out that when you start looking at the whole list, that almost everything in between the first and the last only had a few things. Now, I just wish I had brought it, and I didn't. That's the middle part right there. Ramapithecus is the one that's on this end now. And then it goes across, and it becomes man. Well, you see why he held this up. Can you draw a line between ape and human in that thing? The problem was he said it was the evidence, right? This is not the evidence. So it's wrapped up with interpretation. I don't mind if they do it. I only mind if they don't tell students that they've done it. That is my real concern. When you put evidence down and you wrap your own drawings around it, that bothers me if you do not tell students that that's what you're doing. And unfortunately, and surprising to you perhaps, most biology teachers don't know that. In high school, they don't know. That's evidence to them, too. So I started looking around some more, and that's what I just read you about the palate unmistakably human in shape. So they put that up on the shelf after all. Didn't have any more Ramapithecus stuff, but we did get more Ramapithecus stuff. And this is what comes before and after. And so you have Solo Man, Ramapithecus, Oreopithecus, which has nothing to do with Oreos, and Dryopithecus. And what you find is that they also have just a few bones out of the whole thing. So you're now looking at least four of this chart that have this little tiny bit. The whole thing about all those bones would fit in a peach basket, that's basically what you have. I'm telling you, do not get off on the tack that you might want to go of saying you are just dishonest. Because most biologists in high school particularly will not know that the chart's dishonest. So be kind to them. They just don't know. So what did I do? Well, Ramapithecus. I went to a friend of mine who the mom of one of the kids that was on the soccer team I coached. And she was an artist, and I said, you know, can you draw some intermediate overheads for me? And I said, I'd like one where the hair is gone and you can just see the muscles. Then I want one where the muscles are gone, you can just see the skeleton. So you see where I was going on that. So she drew this one. I was really proud of her. You know, she did a really good job. She could have done far better than that if she'd taken the time, but that's what she did right off the bat. So I appreciated it. Okay. And then here's the skeleton that she put in there. And I thought that was really good because I was moving down towards the evidence, and that's the evidence. A few teeth, part of a jaw, and you can't quite see the palate there because it fell down into the teeth. Okay. This is the evidence. That's the interpretation. That's the evidence. That's the interpretation. And remember what I'm saying. It does you no good. It helps no one if you get all upset and you're hollering about how dishonest they are and they're ignorant and all. They don't even know. I cannot tell you how many biologists have come up to me after my meetings and said, you know, I never knew that. I never knew that. And so I'm going to pitch the idea of a particular type of attitude. I may not have said that before, But the attitude that we have in our discussions is critical. So if you stay calm and you say, well, I'm sorry, but it is true. Do you want me to show you where I got that and so on? And then they understand you're trying to help them understand something that they're probably really embarrassed about because they didn't know it. So there's your evidence, there's your interpretation, and that would have been true for all of these. Now, I don't want you to think they didn't find more of Ramapithecus, because they did. Somebody says, well, why are you using something from 1970? Because for most of these things that they have, they do not have complete skeletons. And now the museums are actually putting a different color in when they don't have that bone. And I think that came because creationists put pressure on them that they weren't being honest to people who came to the museum if they didn't put that in. So they have to put in the best that they have. So they did find more. But if you look at this, what you'll find is, and this is what I think is amazing. Wait, I can do that. See this line, vertebrae? I want you to notice what they had when they drew that chart. So you got two here for Pliopithecus. You've got two here for the Australopithecines. The others had no vertebrae. So when you draw it so that it's standing up straight or leaning over, would you not have to have some vertebrae to help you? But when a person believes something so strongly, and we need to be careful about it ourselves, when we believe something so strongly, sometimes we just don't ever check to see if we're right, or if that's still true, or if there's something else that we've learned that we need to tuck into that equation. All of us can do that. You know, and if I can do it, you can do it. Evolutionists can do it. People can do it in any aspect of our society. So you just, every once in a while, it's really good. If you have some feeling about a passage and you say, well, I always thought of it this way, but what about, then go on and study that out. You will never be wrong in using the scriptures to guide you in this life. God made your body. He can tell you. He can tell you what's the best way to live in it. And it's not a matter of doing bumper sticker scriptures, putting them on your car, and getting your daily scripture out of context without you looking at the whole passage. Look at whole passages. I challenge you to take one of those chimney corner scriptures, or just a scripture that's come out of the Proverbs or any place, and just go back and read the entire chapter and study over it and see if you look at that verse the same way again. Sometimes you will be shocked that that was not the context of that passage. So don't beat yourself up. Just say, I need to be more careful. So that was what they had. It doesn't do me any good to shine it back there. This is what they had in 1972. Now, everything else that I've shown and will show in my presentations came from evolutionary textbooks. This one happened to come from John, what's his name? I know him. I actually have talked to him. Anyway, he was the one that did this particular chart. Now, admittedly, there have been a lot of Ramapithecuses found. Ramapithecuses. There's a lot of them that have been found. Now, this was the earliest common ancestor in a direct line to humans with a palate that was unmistakably human in shape. So once they found all of those extra skeletons of Ramapithecus, what happened to its classification? Anybody know? They put it as the ancestor to the orangutan, and they took it out of the human line completely. So I have a question about that palate. That was a bone, or fossilized bone, and that remarkably human, unmistakable human palate is sitting on somebody's shelf someplace, but apparently it is no longer absolutely human. But that bone is still sitting on somebody's shelf, and I can't find it. I'd love to find it, take pictures of it myself, because they based a whole skeleton, and that was one of the few pieces they had. They said it was right in the direct line to men, and I would just like to see it, take pictures of it. It's got to be there someplace. It didn't disappear. Now, I'm poking a little fun there. But what you find is that when these charts were put together, there really were just a basket full of bones, and they drew around it. And I don't care that they did. They have a right to the evidence, just like me. They have a right to pick and choose. They have a right to interpret it. They can do the interpretation. I do the interpretation on lots of things based on things I know from the scripture that they would disagree with. So this idea of interpretation, don't get angry with it. Just say, I don't mind that you've interpreted that way. Just don't show it to the students without explaining what you've done. That's an honest statement. So, thought for the day. Great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, and small minds discuss people. I have no idea why that's in there. All right, so we're going to talk about the bone peddlers for just a second. William Fix wrote this book, and it really had to do with this whole concept of the bones and what they are selling them for, okay? This one is the proposed human ancestors, the kind of common ancestors that they had found. Now, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Not back there, see?
Hello, Warren.
Nobody? Can you hear me now? Wish I got paid like that guy got paid. Okay, so you can hear me now. So the one that came first was Neanderthal, or Tall. They'll mock you if you say Neanderthal. It's Tall. Neanderthal. So here's Neanderthal, 1856. Most early evolutionists thought that was the common ancestor between ape and man. And it stayed that way until the 1970s. I remember Steve Wolfgang telling me he went to the Children's Museum up in Indiana, in Indianapolis, and they still had it as the common ancestor to man in 1970. You know, it had been abandoned by most people long before that. All right? But you know Neanderthal because you have Barney Rubble and Fred Flintstone, because all of the early caveman stuff came off of that skeleton, okay? Homo erectus, you have all of that. And look, here's Ramapithecus didn't show up until 1964. That means that all of these were thrown out. They were not the early ancestor. The Ramapithecus came up in 1964, and they just keep on coming. We're in the Australopithecines now, but they're making changes there too. So every once in a while, they throw one out. They say, no, that's not really in the line. And then they throw another out, and that's fine. All right? But right now, after they've done that, you might expect that the next three or four that they have will be thrown out as well. They find some reason to take it out of the line to man. So I want you to remember David Pilbeam and Elwin Simmons, because it says right here, found to be the ancestor of the orangutan in 1979. Hence my comment about where's the palate? Not where's the beef, where's the palate? I just want the palate. And if you can find it for me, I would love it. I just don't know where to look. I know there's a way, so somebody with a will should do that. So there's Neanderthaler. Do you recognize him? You've seen this picture before, haven't you? So that was the one that was found in 1856. Then there was Zinchanthropus. Zinchanthropus was probably the most preserved, 400 pieces of the skull that were able to be put back together to produce this image of Zinchanthropus. However, when you look at those, you may notice that those are three radically different drawings based on those bones, right? So what you have is three very industrious pieces of interpretation laid over the bones. Doesn't bother me that they do it, but people need to understand it. So They can do a lot of reconstruction. I don't want you to think that I don't believe that, because I do believe that. Okay? Gorky Park was the first time I ever saw this kind of reconstruction in a movie. And it was really incredible. I just had never seen anything about it at that point as a biologist. That's a very old film. But this is what they do. They can actually look at the muscle attachments on the skull to figure out the approximate strength of the muscle. And of course, they're still doing a lot of comparative stuff. They're looking at other muscles like that in living things today. They do a lot of that stuff. But they can eventually put skin on this, and they can figure out approximately how much space the muscles would take, and they really can do an incredible job on this now. All right. They weren't doing it back then. So that's pretty modern looking man, isn't it? Yeah, I like it too. So who's this? Y'all haven't seen this one? This is Neanderthal, the same bones as that we just looked at a minute ago. That's how human he could have looked. In fact, that got to be such a thing with the newspapers and magazines that they dressed this thing up in a suit and a tie and put hair on it. You know? And I've had people tell me point blank that this guy looks like somebody they know. It was the director of the cultural center where all the acts went on in Danville, Kentucky at Center College. Just looks like the same guy. So you can make Neanderthal that modern. So as Christians, you really should give up the Fred Flintstone stuff. You cannot watch that anymore, or I'm going to withdraw from you. Okay. And you do not care. So anyway, I want to read some things out of U.S. News and World Report, because these were things that had nothing to do with biologists. All of this is actually straight from the magazine. For years, scenes of the daily life of our ancient ancestors have been rendered with a dab of science and a bucket full of speculation, based as much on wishful thinking or intellectual fashion as on the scanty fossil evidence left by our ancestors. These portrayals of early man at various times suggest he was a violent ape, a noble hunter, or a cooperative food sharer living in harmony with nature. That's true. The first part of that statement, I've heard lots of Bible believers say to people, you know, it's just a lot of little bit of science and a bucket full of speculation. It's nothing really different from me saying that was a little bit of evidence and a lot of speculation and interpretation. But this was not written by scientists, it was written by scientists about scientists, and it had nothing to do with this argument. So I'm going to skip around a little bit, but it says the emerging view of early and modern man is a result not of new fossil finds, but of a striking shift in attitude among paleoanthropologists. You may not catch that right off, but what it's saying is the bones are the same. There's no new fossil finds, but they have shifted in their attitude. I don't know what that means in a scientific sense. I've shifted in my attitude, therefore I'm not looking at the evidence in the same way. What that does is absolutely confirm the problem of having your own interpretations that you put on your evidence. And it is the thing that all scientists are supposed to watch for when they're doing research, that they don't put their own, they don't look for the evidence that says what they believe. They don't wrap their own interpretation in it. It's hard to do. It says researchers realize that in the past, they often reconstructed our ancestors' lives and their bodies, I should say, starting with assumptions about what early humans ought to be like, and then searching for fossil evidence to support those assumptions. Well, that's kind of what I was saying, you know. This was long after I came up with this from my own textbooks. I just want you to know that. As a result, many of the past scenarios of how early humans lived, while containing elements of truth, told more about modern humans that devised them than the ancient hominids they purported to describe. So when the scenarios came out, it really reflected back on our own thinking instead of what was being shown in the fossil record. And I think that's remarkable. And it's honest. So don't get angry. You know, just show them quotes like this. Just show them. Because just because I change in my attitude, I tell you, I ran into this in my own field when I went to this international symposium that only occurs once every 4 years and had not been in the United States. It was the Botanical Congress, and it hadn't been in the United States for years and years and years. They came to the gardens out in St. Louis. That's where we held it. And all of us who are taxonomists, all of us who are systemicists, all of us who are into taxonomy and systematics, we were just totally shocked because all the papers had to do with molecular biology. And one of the people that was speaking said, we need to take away the names of the species and give them numbers. And we were all like, we had no idea what that came from. But they shifted in their view of how they look at the evidence because they made this big shift in their view towards molecular biology and what it can tell us when we sequence DNA. So I've gone through this myself. But the truth is, when people draw these scenarios up, they have to make a lot of interpretive decisions. And you need to be aware of that and just ask them for it. So this is the way they would normally walk. That is a ape's normal way of walking. This was interesting because this was a late drawing, and I was so surprised to find that they drew it with hair. Because it was 1981 when Science Magazine debunked the idea that there was hair on there. There's no hair on any of these things. So I was really disappointed that they went back, fell into the same habit. But sometimes when you should make a change in your thinking, you fall back on what you have traditionally believed. A mistake that can happen to all of us too. So, sorry, forgot to put that in there. That was shameful. Still being drunk. Okay, I thought it was. So here's a guy with his skeleton. Oh, let's talk about this a second. Who are these people? No. Who? Wilt Chamberlain is the tall one. Yeah, Willie Shoemaker. That's a real picture. That's not in the wax museum. That is the difference in their height. One is African-American, one is white. Although you would not be able to tell that from fossils. So anytime they draw any of those fossils and they put a dark face on them, that's wrong, because they cannot possibly know that. And they have been chastised about that numerous times. But that one just had it. So if these bones fossilized from these two men, and they were found in the same rock strata, would they be considered to be the same species? I don't think so. There are definitely some structural differences in Occidental white people skeletons from African American. Somebody would make a big deal out of that. They'd be put in different species. They might even be put in different genera. Or they might be marked as the largest and the tallest of this new thing that we created. But they wouldn't know what they look like. They would not have a clue what that was. And that's the kind of thing that we run into. They might deduce that they had white coats and pants. Maybe they're good at doing that. I doubt if they would have guess the ties. Don't mind it. I just want them to think about what would be the consequences of some things like this. Now, I want to talk about Jesus a second as we close. That is Jesus and his disciples just about capsizing on the lake. These are probably the waves that come down Lake Gennesaret are many times 8 feet high. It's one of those things where the winds blow long way down the thing. So the Sea of Galilee kinds of storms are really quite serious. Jesus wasn't afraid. Christians do not need to be afraid. We do not need to be afraid of anything. We need to put our trust in the Lord. That's what Christians do. They put their trust in the Lord. There are always disappointing things that happen in our lives, things that we wish wouldn't happen. But I have looked at many of the things that have happened in my life, and I know some of you would say the same thing, and realized later that if it had not been for that bad thing that happened, I would not have appreciated or may not have even gotten the good thing that was coming along. I've almost never talked to a Christian who did not have one of those events that they could look back on. Jesus was asleep. Why was he asleep? He put his trust in God. He had no fear. When he woke up, he took care of the situation. Stop. The winds and the waves obeyed his will. Peace be still, peace be still. One of my favorite songs. Jesus did not want to go and die. He did it. He did not go because he wanted pain. Some people like pain like that. It's ridiculous to me. But he did not want to go because he knew he would be tortured before he was put on the cross and then have those nails driven through his feet and his hands. That was not his purpose. The ones that he was going to save in the boat, the sinners that were his disciples, right? The sinners that were his disciples. Is there any such thing as a good person, or are we not all sinners who can be good for a while, maybe the rest of our lives after we're baptized? But we weren't good before, we wouldn't have been baptized. We wouldn't have felt like we needed to come to Jesus. Just we'd have thought we were perfect. There were sinners in the boat with him. He was pure. He was not worried. They were worried. Why? Because they weren't focused on him. They were focused on the waves. And so they woke him up. We're going to perish. We're going to perish. You've got to get us out of this mess. And he goes, stay still. And the winds and the waves abate as well. In our lives, each of us is going to go through some really hard times. We're going to face some things where we will be humiliated. Not always just for our faith, but because we are trying to live that faith. These people don't know about our faith, but we are different from them. They see us as different. We react differently and so on. But it doesn't keep the hurt out when people chastise you or kind of cast you out of their group. One of the things that was interesting to me, I'm talking about one at the beginning of my graduate career, when I ran into the evolution professor in a lab. There were other graduate students around, and he got right up in my face. He was furious. He got right up in my face, and he said, Aiken, you better change your views, or you will not, I guarantee you, you will not get a master's from this program. Now, aside from the fact that that's illegal, it was humiliating. It brought me down. I was 21 years old. My knees were shaking. I don't know about you. I mean, I just couldn't believe he said that. And so later on, I had an entire department at my university who wrote to the dean of our college and lobbied for them not to give me tenure on the basis of my beliefs. But he did. Those are illegal things, and you're excluded. And I found out that when I went to my biological meetings, these people who treated me so nice, so sorry about that, these people who treated me so nice as friends, really, in our department at school, would not associate with me when we went to the conferences. They didn't want to be seen with me. They wouldn't come to my talks. I was boycotted at the University of Kentucky. They talked about boycotting me when I did a seminar for our graduate students. They talked about boycotting me. And I know that that happened because I have another friend who believes like me, and they don't know that they do. And I told them, don't tell them. Just keep believing what you believe and show it in your life. So those kinds of things, when you're trashed like that, when you're treated like an outcast, those are really difficult things. And I did not have any fun at that. But sometimes we're going to go through that kind of stuff. And we need to recognize that Jesus is the answer to the question that you have. I had a friend one time, he saw that bumper sticker, Jesus is the answer. I'm sure all of us have seen that bumper sticker at some time. And his immediate thought was, what's the question? Jesus is the answer, what's the question? And then after a while he said, oh, I get it. He's the answer to all the questions. We need to remember that. Strengthen your faith. We all are tempted. We all struggle. It is the plight of man to not be able to direct his own steps. The scriptures say that very clearly. So when you're trying to walk the narrow way, you need to say, Lord, you're going to have to help me. You're just going to have to help me. Because you're not going to be able to do this alone. Now, one of the things that he's offered is forgiveness of sins. People are baptized into Christ, and there is this miraculous cutting away of the sins of the flesh. And if you haven't done that, you need to at some point when you decide that you need to give your life over to Jesus. That's just a reality. Now, we'll help you tonight if you want to do that. I appreciate your attention. You all have been very kind.